Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast.
Good Monday afternoon. It's the show on 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Steve Goldstein. Not much going on in Valley traffic, but if you're in the West Valley right now, watch out for a collision I-10 eastbound at Watson Road. We're looking for mostly sunny skies today around the Valley. Looking for a high temperature near 109. That would be a couple of degrees above normal. Should be clear tonight with lows in the lower 80s, and then sunny tomorrow with a high of 109. Currently, relative humidity is at 11%, sunny and 103 degrees. A former border vigilante convicted of sex crimes against a child has been sentenced to 19 and a half years in prison. As KJZZ's Matthew Casey reports from the West Valley Bureau, the victim's mother hoped Chris Simcox would get more time behind bars.
Wearing jail stripes and shackles, Simcox declined to speak during his sentencing hearing for two counts of sexual molestation and one count of giving pornography to a five-year-old girl. The prosecutor wanted the founder of the Minuteman Group to serve consecutive terms for molestation, but the judge decided the sentences will be concurrent. Michelle Lynch is the victim's mother. She says her daughter has been to counseling and has not wanted to talk about what happened.
She'll work through it however it is that she needs to, and I'm going to be there to help her through that. You know, and if he appeals, I'll be back at this courthouse.
The judge gave Simcox credit for more than 3 years of time served. The former elementary school teacher and Senate candidate turns 56 in November. Matthew Casey, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
The Arizona Supreme Court has ruled vehicles can be searched based solely on the odor of marijuana. As KJZZ's Phil Latzman reports, justice has rejected claims that the smell alone isn't evidence of a crime.
The case arrived in the Arizona High Court after a pair of state appeals courts had conflicting opinions. A Phoenix panel ruled marijuana odor was sufficient evidence, while a Tucson panel decided it was not. The justices unanimously agreed with the Phoenix judges, putting aside arguments that the state's medical marijuana law means the smell by itself wasn't indicative of a potential crime. Chief Justice Scott Bales, writing for the court, says marijuana remains illegal for the vast majority of Arizonans, and that detection of a smell was, quote, fair probability that contraband or evidence of a crime was present. The court specifically rejected arguments that a search based merely on odor runs afoul of constitutional provisions protecting the right to privacy. Justices, though, did rule the 2010 medical marijuana law provides the legal foundation for a search to be dispelled. Phil Latzman, KJZZ News.
After a spate of police shootings over the past week, Phoenix City leaders urged calm and called for any protesting to be put off to allow for a cooling off period. But several hundred protesters defied those concerns and marched through the city for 3 hours Friday night. KJZZ's Jimmy Jenkins was there and joins me now. Jimmy, what was the atmosphere like? There's been a lot of talk about pepper spray and a confrontation, but what was the mood like all night?
It was actually mostly calm. Protesters were gathered singing in front of City Hall at the very beginning of the night.
Swing low, sweet chariot, coming for to carry me home.
Dallas Diaz was passing out candles to marchers with her brother. She said contrary to what the city leaders were asking for, it's important to get out and be heard right after the events.
It's important to show that no matter what happens, we're not going to be silenced. Fear is what leads to hate. So together out here, I feel like being able to conquer that fear of coming all out together, that's exactly what they don't want. They don't want people to come out together. They don't want people to come out and heal with their community.
The protesters then marched through the city, stopping at various intersections to shout slogans. But all the while, Steve, they were totally chaperoned by the police. It was very contained. Police were always really on the perimeter. They'd closed down an agreed upon route and sealed off all side streets and really gave the march what seemed like room to breathe.
Well, so what happened and how did it go from such a calm movement to a confrontation?
Well, the Phoenix police say they had an agreement between Chief Yonner and Jarrett Maupin, who was organizing the march, that said they would stick to a pre-approved route. But as the protest headed north on 7th Street at the end of the night, marchers decided to attempt to take the interstate and shut down the I-10. This is Sergeant Vincent Lewis from Phoenix PD speaking late Friday night.
It was conveyed to the Phoenix police that the demonstrators intended to block traffic on the freeway. At a certain point, the decision was made by the police chief that under the circumstances, the demonstration was determined to be unsafe to continue on. That's when the officers from the Phoenix Police Department formed a line.
Maupin said it was never their intention to actually go on the freeway, but only to imply the threat of shutting down the 10, which in fact did happen. So to prevent this, the police made a stand at 7th and Fillmore, and that's when we see the tear gas and pepper spray was used on some protesters.
So it sounds like a heat-of-the-moment change. Did this add tension that really didn't need to be there?
I think it was a combination of the protest leader losing some control as well as the police kind of throwing down a gauntlet that caused the confrontation. There were police in riot gear, which we hadn't seen at all night, and helicopters were circling overhead. And I think with recent events, the crowd was very skittish and went from calm and organized to very panicked very quickly. So it all added up to a small skirmish, but even then there were only 3 arrests and minor injuries, and then, you know, most of the crowd dispersed.
KJZZ's Jimmy Jenkins. Jimmy, thanks.
My pleasure, Steve.
The Phoenix police have a community response team to deal with these kinds of situations. They were coordinating with protest leaders before and during the march to try to bridge relationships between the police and the community. But are they doing enough? Joining me now is Prentice Moore with 100 Black Men of Arizona. Prentice, what was your reaction to how things were handled on Friday night and the communication between the event organizers and Phoenix police?
Well, from what I'm aware of, there was a pretty good amount of communication and efforts to reach out to the rally organizers. Of course, I know the police department and the mayor, they did not want that rally to occur due to everything that occurred in Dallas the previous day. But the event organizers, they obviously felt it was still important to go ahead with that rally. But from what I was able to observe, it seems like there was a pretty good amount of communication or even attempts at communication.
Prentice, what would you like to see going forward as it relates to the police dealing with communities of color, and especially when we think about young Black men?
One of the things that we do at the 100 Black Men, we mentor youth, primarily African American. However, we also have a large number of Latino Americans as well. And we had somewhat of a town hall on this past Saturday, and there was just, with the youth that we have, one word we kept hearing was fear. There's a lot of fear. And so one of the things that we came up with and that we will suggest to the police department is, especially for those who are coming in, who are trainees, going into the police department, that there be a program in place where they can come in and partner or work with youth in the community to build relationships, kind of get a better understanding of their feelings and their concerns, and actually use this in a way to help prepare the trainees as they go out into their actual roles as police officers. The youth seem to feel like that will be a great way to, maybe it won't alleviate all fears, but it will help bring those concerns, those fears down.
It sounds like increased education, increased communication can lead to trust. It doesn't mean everyone's going to be best friends, but it means like they can at least see that there aren't ulterior motives there.
Oh, man, absolutely. That's what we, with our organization, and I know many organizations in the Valley that work with youth of color, that's what we're striving for. That's what we're stressing. You know, let's be able to sit down at the table and have communications and work on ways together to really have a positive impact on the relations between, you know, law enforcement and the community.
Is it still important to have peaceful rallies going forward, though, to make sure that the message is not, certainly won't be forgotten, but let's say it's not shuffled aside?
I definitely believe in peaceful rallies, you know, making sure that your voice has been heard. I believe in that. I think it's very important. And I also believe that, you know, when you talk to folks, even throughout the community, and maybe even those in law enforcement, they also see the value of peaceful rallies.
That was Prentice Moore with 100 Black Men of Phoenix. So it's July, the legislative primaries aren't until late next month, and some of the races won't even be decided until November. But that hasn't stopped State House Speaker candidates from trying to line up support. Hank Stevenson of the Arizona Capital Times wrote about that this morning and joins me. Hank, is it common for this to be happening in the summer?
Well, this has already been going on for, you know, close to a year now, probably since the 2015 legislative session ended. And it's only heated up since then. A big part of who will be speaker will be determined by the August primary, when some of these heavily Republican legislative districts select their nominees, therefore, you know, probably the winners from the district. So we'll know a little bit more, judging by the type of Republican that gets elected in November, who has a better shot at speaker. But at this point, two out of the three candidates who are running for speaker say they already have the votes, which is only possible if they're being lied to.
How out of the ordinary is it for folks who are trying to be speaker or any other leadership post to be lobbying folks who have not even officially been elected yet?
Well, I think it's pretty normal. You know, you have some people, the real kind of divide in the speakership races is generally kind of more conservative or a more moderate candidate. Those are the two main wings of the Republican Party here at the Capitol. So everybody kind of knows who they want to get elected. You know, the candidates for speaker, people who would probably pick them if given the opportunity. But to actually be out there fundraising, to be endorsing, to be helping candidates in contested primaries, as one of the candidates for speaker, Darren Mitchell, has been doing, is pretty rare. There's kind of an unspoken rule against that.
Hank, I don't want to create controversy where there isn't any, but Darren Mitchell and Don Shooter, who are two of the folks you write about in your piece, have had some controversy in the past. Darren Mitchell, when he was running, people wondered, well, does he actually live in the district? Is he sleeping on a mattress at a friend's house? Don Shooter had the incident with a teacher. Does that stuff matter to people who might support them?
I think it kind of does. You know, I think that Mitchell was never quite able to get over that representative at-large label, or mattress Mitchell, as people call him. And Shooter, you know, his reputation, people generally really like the guy, but they don't take him all that seriously because, you know, he's such a jokester. He wears hats. You know, he freely admits to being a heavy drinker and a joker. In fact, in the letter that he sent out to Republican lawmakers and Republican candidates kind of introducing himself, he specifically said, I'll have to cut back on the drinking and the jokes, and that's okay, I can do it. That's definitely something on the mind of the lawmakers who will be selecting their next speaker, especially, you know, after the way the last 2 years went. I think a lot of people are kind of upset that the moderates supported David Gowan, and he had just a host of problems. I mean, he's still under investigation by the attorney general, so nobody wants to see a repeat of that.
Hank, finally, what sort of leadership, whether moderate or conservative, on the Republican side are people looking for?
One of the main things is just running the trains on time. You know, who's going to be able to, after the last 2 years where things almost always started late, often ended very late, frequently unnecessarily, where you've got, you know, a lot of lawmakers, a lot of staff, reporters waiting around for the House to just conclude its business for the day. And sometimes they take long breaks and, you know, not come back until hours later after the speaker had gone out for dinner or whatever. I think that's a big concern of people, is somebody who can just make the place function. And that's been, you know, a big talking point from Representative J.D. Mesnard, who's running for speaker, is just that, you know, he's a former staffer. He's the former speaker pro tem. And he, you know, wants the place to be run in an orderly fashion.
Hank Stevenson, reporter for the Arizona Capital Times. We've been talking about his latest story about would-be speakers of the House courting the not yet elected. Hank, good to talk with you. Thanks.
Thanks for having me on, Steve.
Now we're going to talk about federal budget policy. Wait, don't run away. There's something new that more of us are going to be able to understand. The Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania recently introduced the Penn-Wharton budget model. It gives you the chance to see how a number of floated policies, at this point focused on Social Security and immigration, would affect the federal budget and then presumably our own budgets. Professor Kent Smetters is the leader of the budget model and joins me to talk more about it. Kent, how confusing is federal budget policy to most Americans?
I think it's completely opaque, because it's pretty opaque to even policymakers in Washington. In fact, one of the reasons why we created a federal budget model is that members of Congress themselves told us that the federal budget process, the impact of their ideas on the budget, on the economy, was very unclear to them, and they wanted a sandbox where they could test their ideas much earlier in the legislative writing process.
Let's dig in a little bit on this. How does it work? Because there are policy combinations. I was amazed at the number of policy combinations, for right. example, with changes in Social Security.
Right. With Social Security, we have 4,096 different combinations that people can try, and they include everything from traditional liberal ideas to the more conservative ideas, and people can really help make up their own mind about different ways of creating solvency for Social Security. And behind it is a very rigorous model that literally starts with census-level data on households, and it tracks them by how many kids they have, the type of education, lots of different factors that create for a very rich environment. And then we, you know, allow policies to be ran on top of that. And so the user gets instant feedback of trying different policies.
You're actually allowing each individual to decide, okay, this is the policy based on what I've heard. I think this is going to work. You don't put a grade on it though, right?
That's right. In fact, we're completely non-normative. By that, we mean we're never going to endorse or criticize a particular policy. We just let the numbers talk for themselves. And certainly some policies are going to be more effective at achieving certain, you know, desired end results.
Ken, one of the other current policies you look at is immigration, which also has a lot of combinations, but nowhere near 4,000. You know, are you able to look at things like, well, what effect would a guest worker program have versus granting citizenship versus deportation?
Right. In fact, so with immigration, it turns out a lot of the ideas that have been discussed in Washington, really on both sides in the last 10 years, can be analyzed using 125 different combinations. And one of the combinations would be things like looking at both legalization, which is, you know, more of a traditional liberal solution, versus deportation, which goes on the other side. And what we find is the proponents of those solutions are, in some sense, over-talking the potential benefit of those approaches, either on jobs or the economy. Rather, what we actually find is that something like a guest worker program, which is much more consistent with current policy these are still undocumented workers, but just creating documentation, but where they don't necessarily qualify for government programs. It actually does fairly well at maximizing both jobs and GDP.
Kent, do you think it's possible that at some point, maybe in the near future, as people are thinking more and more about budgeting, I mean, Arizona, in the course of the Great Recession, got hit extremely hard and was in a horrible deficit, made all sorts of cuts, and now the latest budget year we're in a surplus, and people at that point people have sort of more options. Is this the kind of thing you'd like to see adapt to the state level at some point?
It is. I mean, a lot of people don't realize that, but 40% of all government spending is at the state and local level. So that is definitely in our roadmap that we want individual state-level stakeholders also using these type of tools. I mean, you mentioned Arizona. It's actually a great example where there's too much budgeting that's being done on how is the economy today without thinking about, you know, where are things going over longer periods of time. And so we want to try to stretch people's horizon, not to be just thinking about the budget today or the economy today, but they have a little bit of a longer run picture.
Professor Kent Smetters of the Wharton School. He's in charge of the Penn-Wharton budget model, which just came out last week. We've been talking about it. Kent, thanks so much for the time.
Thanks so much for having me on.
When you give blood, it has to go to a testing facility to be screened for a number of infectious diseases before it can be used to help anyone. But when Arizona State University professor Philip Stafford saw how that testing is done, he saw an opportunity for innovation. Now he's received a $1.2 million grant from the National Institutes of Health to screen our nation's blood supply with a new simple test. And the show's Lauren Gilger got a tour around his lab at ASU's Biodesign Institute to find out how it all works. Hi, Lauren.
Hi, Steve.
So how is donated blood tested now?
So usually blood banks test for about 10 infectious diseases, things like HIV, syphilis, West Nile, before the donated blood can be used for transfusions. And now they use 10 different kits to test for each of those 10 diseases. But Stafford wants to use a process called immunosignaturing to test for all of those diseases at once. So Stafford originally began studying this technique in early detection of cancer. But when he went to get blood samples for his work from a local blood testing facility, he saw how the testing was done.
So we went over to Creative Testing Labs, which is right here in Tempe. So we were just buying samples from them. But while we were in discussions about buying samples for this other project, I saw exactly how they do the blood testing. And I saw how much money it takes and how long it takes. And I thought, this is kind of a slam dunk. We could just do all of your tests in one assay, and you'd never have to buy a new kit if you have tests for a new disease. You just train it, and boom, you're good to go.
So how does this work exactly?
Well, the science is complicated, but basically, instead of testing for individual diseases, Stafford's test would show if the immune system is currently fighting any infection. And this is done in a three-part process that starts inside a room that looks like a photography dark room in the lab. There's a black curtain over the door and all. It's loud in here.
Yeah, they always have fans to draw up some of the smells and things that you typically get when you do synthesis, when you do chemical synthesis. So this long machine with all these little discs is to make a wafer. And this thing that you see, it looks like a darkroom lamp. That's what shines light onto the surface of this wafer. So this thing displays a pattern of light and dark. And the light and dark are to tell the amino acids where to go.
And they found each disease makes a distinctive pattern that they can match with patterns they find in people's blood.
So it's like creating a database of patterns that match each disease.
Exactly. So they're collecting samples from people who have all of these infectious diseases, as well as from healthy people for their research.
They've been tested with the gold standard, the current gold standard. They ship them to us, and we put them on the arrays, and we say what pattern shows up. And interestingly enough, everybody with Chagas that's been exposed to Chagas has the same pattern. Everybody that's been exposed to HIV or HBV or hepatitis C all has the same pattern. And the patterns are different from disease to disease.
In the end, they're going to test samples from hundreds of people 3,200 times and analyze the data they gathered from them.
And what are the implications of this if everything goes as planned?
So Stafford says if this technology does what he thinks it can do, the implications are vast. He says one of the first organizations that became interested in his work was the Defense Threat Reduction Agency, who wanted to work with them on a project that monitors soldiers for diseases.
Because they want to use something like this for their military people that are stationed throughout the world. If you have a lot of people that are traveling through endemic countries, then they pick up these, you know, flu-like diseases, and that could be anything. That could be dengue or chikungunya or the flu. And if we make our product the way we want to make it, it will be able to tell exactly what these people have.
This really sounds like it has the potential to be a game changer, not only for testing blood, but also for lots and lots of other things.
Oh, outbreaks. You know, the flu outbreak is one thing that people often overlook, is every year they have to make a vaccine against the flu. And then they have to test whether or not they hit the right bug, the right variant of the flu. If we are able to monitor people during the flu outbreak, when they go into the doctor and they say, I feel kind of rotten, you test every one of those people and you can find out exactly within a matter of days how close the vaccine was. And if the vaccine is off, they can start making a new vaccine right away. If they have an outbreak like MERS or SARS, where they don't know what it is, but it, you know, people just feel like they have the flu. In the case of SARS, it was deadly. And we could test those people really, really quickly and find out what it is, how to start making a vaccine, and how to sort of contain the outbreak.
And he says he hopes the technology will be affordable for blood testing companies by testing up to 20 people's blood at once.
The show's Lauren Gilger. Lauren, thanks.
Thank you, Steve.
It's the show on 91.5. Thanks for listening. Along with the takeaways, John Hockenberry today, I'm Steve Goldstein. Here's a bit of irresistible tech lore that actually references civil rights history. It seems that MIT engineers from the 1960s, who originally wrote the thousands of literal lines of code for the original Apollo mission, left some graffiti in the fine print on the way to the moon. Secret messages in the form of snarky comments were buried between command lines controlling the lunar spacecraft.
So when the computer code used in the Apollo moon missions was uploaded to a popular programming website last week, the wider world of programmers began sharing the paleo-snarky tidbits. Keith Collins, a reporter with Quartz, said there is a mood of celebration in the programmer world this week.
Programmers, when they started dissecting this code, were so interested in the comments because it's just the most readable thing. It kind of explains what's going on. And what they found is that there were a lot of comments that weren't just explaining what was going on, but were actually jokes and references to what was going on at the time. One of my favorites was they had a subroutine file that was called Burn Baby Burn.
Thank you. Yeah. It's just what we need. Yeah.
And in the code, there was an introduction to that. And I think the introduction comments were added a little later. But they explained there was a radio DJ. The L.A. riots were going on at the time. And when a radio DJ would in L.A. would play the new hot record, they would say, "Burn, baby, burn." People working on this software said, you know, we were reading the news. We knew what was going on, although we were in the lab all the time. And that routine that's named Burn, Baby, Burn is the master ignition routine.
That's amazing. I mean, how you close the arc of the violence that was taking place then and what we got going on now. And then, of course, there are just joke references, Shakespeare and Easter, because I guess they were doing a lot of programming in the spring.
Oh, yeah. They referenced a Shakespeare quote. I have it here if you want me to.
Oh, sure.
It's a Shakespeare quote that mentions nouns and verbs. The reason that they used the quote, presumably, is that the programming language that they created used a structure of nouns and verbs to say a verb would be run program and a noun would be something like time to ignition. There's this really funny part. My very favorite is this is all within comments. The comment is addressing the astronaut. So it says, "Astronaut, colon, please crank the silly thing around." And then the next line says, "Terminate." And the next line says, "Proceed, see if he's lying." And then the next line says, "Enter initialize landing radar." And then that section closes with, "Off to see the wizard." and Ron Berkey, who transcribed this code, explained to me that code is about positioning the antenna for the lunar module. This code was written such a long time ago and has actually been available online for quite a while. The fact that simply by putting it on this new platform where people where programmers tend to congregate today, it really, you know, it just exploded online as soon as it was put on there. People started dissecting these comments and finding interesting bits. And I think a really interesting thing about this is that now, all this time later, it still kind of inspires this awe. You know, this is the code that brought us to the moon. This is, you might not understand it when you look at the code itself, but, you know, we have these comments. And even all this time later, people look at this and say, wow, you know, this is available to me. This is this historic sort of artifact, and now the whole world has access to it.
And thousands of miles of code, or thousands of lines of code.
That's right.
Is it the case that a typical upload of an Instagram file from a 14-year-old is millions of lines of code?
I don't know.
Maybe.
Well, Instagram itself is probably many more lines of code than this is. And yeah, they did a lot of work with very little space. One programmer has worked out that an iPhone, which we all carry around in our pockets today, could have run the software for 120 million Apollo missions.
Keith Collins, a reporter for Quartz, thanks so much.
Thank you, John.
That's John Hockenberry at The Takeaway. As we continue our celebration of the working life, we're looking at the people who do the jobs you sometimes don't see or don't think about. We're thinking about the jobs around Metro Phoenix that might not be what you expect. Perhaps you've been to one of the valley's casinos to play a few hands of poker. At one resort, licensed massage therapists provide chair massages during your game of choice so you can keep playing. Today it's late night on the job giving massages in the poker room.
My name is Michelle Dawson, and I am a card room massage therapist for Talking Stick Resort. So they have to get a minimum of 10 minutes, but they can get a max of 30. It's really kind of like any other massage job. There's a lot of regulars, like they're here every day. It's kind of funny. So Saturday nights, there's always two people. And then like I said, Sundays, there's always just, I work by myself, which is nice too. Usually on a Saturday night, it can be anywhere from like 12 to 16 people. When we massage people, we actually give it to them where they're sitting. They usually flip their chair around. And then you just put this little pillow kind of right in front of them, and they can still play poker.
Are you available?
I am available. Now, most of the time, my hands aren't too bad. If I do, I'll switch up how I'm massaging the person. I don't only use my hands. I might use my forearms or my elbows or my knuckles. So depending on how the massage is going and how their body composition is and like the density of their muscles, then I'll change on how I'm working on them. So, like, I asked him specifically, like, what he would like. So for him, upper back, neck, and then lower back. 15 minutes. Kind of, you just kind of do whatever they want, within reason. Most of the time, you'll be working on somebody, and then somebody else at the table will be like, you know what, I'll take one. And then somebody else will be, oh, I'll take one too. So yeah, in between each person, go wash my hands, sanitize the pillow, and then go back out on the floor. So it's really just kind of like back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. Alrighty.
Thank you.
You're welcome. A lot of people just, they just want that human touch that they might not get outside of here. And touch is so healing, even in the smallest amount. And everybody needs that. I love my other job that I have, but I really like working here. It's every night is a new adventure. Just to see the person smile and like the relief that they feel after the massage is, for me, that's the best.
Check, check.
That's Michelle Dawson giving chair massages at Talking Stick Resort Casino. In KJZZ News at 2:39, the Goodyear City Council may sign off on plans for roughly 160 new homes tonight. But as KJZZ's Matthew Casey reports from the West Valley Bureau, the subdivision lies in the same area where residents worry that development has expanded faster than fire service.
There's currently just one fire station in Estrella Mountain Ranch. A second was slated to open in 2009, but the Great Recession forced the city to postpone the project. Goodyear is now growing again and on track to issue about 1,000 single-family home permits for the second year in a row. Christopher Baker is the city's director of development services. If the project is approved, he says roads, water, and sewer lines need to be built before new home construction can start.
By the time they go through that process, actually construct the improvements out on the site, the soonest you're likely to see homes out there would be early to mid-summer next year.
Baker says Goodyear is working with developers to make sure the area has sufficient fire service. A citywide study on where to build new fire stations should be complete this fall. Matthew Casey, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
Policymakers and residents of the city of Phoenix have been debating whether or not trails should be closed when certain temperatures are reached. 110 degrees was the number commonly cited. But what if you've decided to go out and think you can handle the heat, but somehow forgot to bring some water with you? That's where Gabriel Cruz comes in. He's unofficially a water angel who tries to make sure you don't get dangerously parched, and he's with me. Gabriel, when did you get interested in providing people with water?
In 2004, I was involved with a No More Deaths down in the southern border of Arizona, helping immigrants that were crossing, may have run out of water. I was providing first aid with the No More Deaths group. Me being from Phoenix, I was just an eye-opener. Since I love to hike, I'm an Eagle Scout, so I've been hiking since I've been young. I said, maybe I can do something in my neighborhood or my area. And that's where the idea came up.
Now, you also had an experience of your own. Hope you're not too embarrassed to tell us about this, especially as an experienced hiker and an Eagle Scout. But you ran into this as well, right? The authorities had to come and kind of help you out.
Yes. Back last year in June, I started early. It usually takes me about 2 hours to go up and down.
Which mountain are we talking about?
And I'm talking about Paestewa Peak. Okay. I can usually take about an hour and a half to 2 hours up and down. And I mean, I do it every other day usually. I started early because I knew it was going to be hot that day. 8 o'clock, I started. I got to the top, and the sun was just blazing down hot. And I said, there's no way I'm coming down. So I found some shade, and I stayed up there. And I said, I'm going to wait for the sun to come down. As I was coming down, the rescuers were looking for me. I was supposed to meet somebody for lunch, and I didn't show up. One thing I tell people, if you're going to go hiking, tell someone where you're going to go, what time you're going to come back. And it was funny because the helicopter was circling around, and I was telling another hiker as I was coming down, I was like, man, I wonder who got stuck up here. And the helicopter, of course, was looking for me. It was about 4 p.m. at this time. And
wow, so you had gotten there at 8 in the morning. As yes. You said, when things are going well, you would have been done a little after 10, and it's still wow. So that's a long day.
And I had plenty of water. My body was not retaining the water. Mm-hmm. I had no salt in my body. People make fun of these hikers. Oh, they should take plenty of water. You should be hydrated. Yes, that's true. You also have to have some salt in your body to retain that water, some electrolytes.
If someone were out hiking, Are they going to see Gabe Cruz out there ready to give them supplies, or do you have a team? How's it working for you?
I usually just work alone. I usually take a 40 case of Kirkland water. I freeze it overnight, and if I know it's going to be hot and I'm not off of work, I'm hiking up Piesto, and I'm leaving little caches of water in different sections, the different benches. Sometimes I leave boxes of apples or pears. Sometimes I take granolas, and I just leave a note and tell hikers, take one. It's just positivity. I'm about positivity and, you know, hey, you know, there's a good Samaritan out looking out for us, you know. Me and my brother's a big supporter of what I'm doing. He helps me out financially in these situations. Sometimes he accompanies me, but when he can't accompany me, he gives me, here's some money for the water or whatever.
Do you think of yourself as a water angel?
Not really. I'm about giving service. And my friends always say, you're the luckiest person I know. I believe that it comes back.
What do you think about the so-called stupid hiker law? Do you think that would be a good idea or a bad idea?
I haven't really made up my decision on that. I see both sides of the picture. Like I said, I had my incident, and I'm an experienced hiker, so I wouldn't call myself a stupid hiker. Then I see these unexperienced hikers where they're climbing up, and I'm like, what are you doing? You're not prepared.
That's Gabriel Cruz, who's made a habit of leaving water bottles for hikers in Phoenix. The Tres Rios Wetlands Project was completed by the City of Phoenix in 2010. An area once patched with farm fields was turned into a network of waterways and greenery, and it's grown since then. Pay a visit today, and it's clear the wetland has taken on a life of its own. The show's Annika Klein takes us there.
In a chorus of birds, it's hard to pick out a single voice, unless you're a birder who's been listening to this song for many years.
This is a common yellowthroat, which I hear singing right now.
Mark Larson is one of those birders.
This is a species that's tied to wetlands, so it would be otherwise rare in the desert, as you can imagine.
The Tres Rios Wetlands is a man-made oasis in southwest Phoenix, next to the Salt River. Larson says it's one of the best birding sites in the state.
One time I came here and I saw a species of bird that normally is not in the state of Arizona at all. It's called a painted bunting.
What the painted bunting doesn't know is this wetland wasn't made for it or the other critters that live here. Not for the beavers or bullfrogs or the hundreds of other birds. It was made to treat the wastewater of all the people who live outside it.
I've been doing Tres Rios Wetlands now for almost 20 years.
Ron Elkins is with the City of Phoenix's Water Department, and he's seen the wetlands grow from a small research project to the full-size wetlands that now stretch from 91st Avenue to 115th. It's a web of water and plants so dense you can't see the desert beyond, and it's a cost-effective way to treat water.
What would cost several billion dollars to do with concrete and steel has cost you a minimal level down in the millions to do it naturally.
But it's also unconventional.
One thing that's true in wetlands, 2 + 2 = 4. And it is not about you got this much water coming in and that much water coming out.
The team at first was just focused on the water. But some early mistakes taught them to see the bigger picture. Like when swaths of algae attempted to smother the lakes. They realized they needed to foster an environment where the algae and the bacteria were balanced.
We thought it would be, you turn this knob, it does this, you push that button. It's not like that at all.
Now that the wetlands area is more mature, they mostly step back and let it do its thing. And since then, Elkins has seen some pretty incredible wildlife just show up.
We noticed within the first year or two that we were starting to get some different populations of fish.
Fish that somehow made it through the various barriers the department set up. That sure made the pelicans happy, though. Here's Mark Larson, the birder.
American white pelicans have been wintering here. They breed in the upper Midwest on prairie ponds.
Larson says it's not unusual for these snowbirds to winter in Arizona.
But there now are a few that actually stay here all year.
And that's unusual.
That is unprecedented.
There's also a lot of people flocking in, researchers, students, and nature enthusiasts. The city has documented visitors from 23 states and Canada. So the department is turning its attention toward growing the recreational side of the wetlands. Their next step is to connect the Tres Rios Trail with the Maricopa Trail and promote this as a place for anyone to stop by and discover something new.
For the show, I'm Annika Klein.
As one longtime phrase goes, there are no atheists in a foxhole. The interpretation is that when faced with death, a person wouldn't want to be without the belief in a higher being or an afterlife. ASU physicist Lawrence Krauss took on a similar notion recently in The New Yorker. His piece is titled The Fantasy of the Deathbed Conversion. The idea came about for Krauss when a prominent evangelical Christian wrote about the late commentator Christopher Hitchens, an atheist, and said that Hitchens had been, quote, teetering on the edge of belief. To Krauss, the concept didn't make any sense, and he joins me now to talk about that. Lawrence, why do you think these concepts of the deathbed conversion and no atheists in a foxhole persist?
The only reason I can think of, and I tried to emphasize the piece, is fundamental insecurity. Why do you need people to agree with you if you're completely secure in your own position? I don't think you do. But if somehow you doubt at some level what you're committing to, then it adds to your confidence tremendously, let me put it that way, if you surround yourself with people who agree. And moreover, if there are people you admire intellectually and they don't agree with you, that again, I think is an assault on your confidence. Certainly people go to church every Sunday for community and for other things, but a great part of it is, why would you have to repeat the same stories every week, in and out, year in, year out, if it wasn't a method of trying to reassure yourself that those stories are reasonable? We don't have to have quantum mechanics classes every Sunday where we repeat the same stories to convince ourselves that quantum mechanics works.
How much does it complicate things that there's a need for a human being to think that there is something greater and that we can all sort of come together and coalesce under that?
Well, I think that, I'm not an expert in evolutionary psychology, but there's clearly a good reason for teleology, as the philosophers like to say, for looking for purpose. And there's clearly an evolutionary reason. If you're on the savanna, and a prehistoric man was on a savanna, and the leaves were rustling behind you, you could assume there's no purpose reason for that, or you might assume there's a predator, a lion behind it. Those people who didn't look for the story didn't survive to reproduce. So I think we are definitely hardwired to want to look for purpose. What's surprising to me, though, particularly, is why this need to find deathbed conversions, first of all, is such a Christian activity as opposed to others. And secondly, how people could think that somehow why people would want to convert. Atheism in general is not a belief system like Christianity. It's a willingness to take the world as it is and deal with empirical evidence and not accept things without evidence. Why would someone decide that someone would throw that out and then choose that particular religion instead of the thousand others? It's a very presumptuous picture. The people that people try to convert on their deathbed or claim that have converted are always the admirable intellects, the people who have spoken out most strongly in one way or another, from Thomas Paine to Darwin in a sense, and more recently Christopher Hitchens, have spoken out most cogently against religion. And I find it telling that those are the people that some people wish to try and claim they have won over for their cause. And finally, as I put in my piece, what I find even more unfortunate about this is if you think about it, I mean, of course, to some extent, religion tries to claim converts by presenting them with awful alternatives, hell, for example. But if you think that a conversion that takes place because of the pain, someone's in incredible pain or mental torment, and if you think that that's the only way to convert someone, it's like waterboarding them. I mean, what does it say about the beliefs that you're trying to convert them to?
Do you think there is something fundamentally missing from people who continue to lean on that?
No, I it's easy to be patronizing and say, oh, if you just were sensible like me or something like that. But, you know, look, we all do that. We're human beings. We all want to believe. Each of us believes 10 impossible things before breakfast in order to make it on our way to work. We all invent stories that allow us to make it through the day. What is important, I think, is that, and if those stories help us make it through the day, so be it. But when these ideas become institutionalized and become bases of power and decision-making in the public arena, that's where you could worry about. To me, that's a problem.
That's ASU physicist Lawrence Krauss, head of the Origins Project. We've been talking about his New Yorker essay, The Fantasy of the Deathbed Conversion.
Monday, Monday, can't trust that day. Monday, Monday, sometimes it just turns out that way.
Hey, guys.
What's up, G?
Want to go to Tchotchke's? Get some coffee?
Oh, it's a little early. I
gotta get out of here. I think I'm gonna lose it.
Uh-oh. Sounds like somebody's got a case of the Mondays.
So it's Monday, the day of the week that is usually accompanied by pessimism and gloom. Most people look forward to Fridays or Saturdays. Mondays don't get that luxury. But there are different perspectives on what Mondays really mean. Today, I'm joined by columnist Karina Bland of the Arizona Republic and AZ Central. Karina, do you love or hate Mondays?
I actually love Mondays. Like, that's why I could never understand that Carpenter song about, you know, rainy days and Mondays always get me down, because I love Mondays and I love rainy days. So you get two on this, both of those on the same
day. You're living
in
Phoenix and you love rainy days?
Don't you?
Well, yeah, but you don't get a lot of them here.
Right, which is why you have to love them. That's the best. No, Mondays I like because, like, Mondays always go really well for me. Like, I get up on time on Mondays. I get out of the house on time. I pack a lunch. You know, there's an outfit. Like, the house is clean. There's groceries in the refrigerator. Like, Mondays, I'm, like, on it. You know, like, by Thursdays, I'm a mess. Like, there's the house is a mess. I'm a mess. There's nothing to eat. So Mondays are huge. Like, they're like a beginning point for me.
Is that because you're cheating? You're using Saturday and Sunday to get ready for Monday?
Yeah, absolutely. But here's the thing that I think, because you got to kind of build up to Monday. And so I used to always think, well, you use, you know, part of your weekend to get ready. But then once I had a kid, I experienced this thing. It's called, well, I dubbed it the Sunday night meltdown. Because once your kid's in school, if on Sunday night you start saying, oh, okay, where's your math homework and let's do your reading and I need to sign this, well, you have now brought Monday to Sunday, right, and ruined it. So I learned, like, really quickly, like, you can't do that. So, like, I was that mean mom that made him do his homework when he got home from school on Friday, because then we didn't have to deal with it all weekend. And then you don't have to disrupt the fun on Sunday and Saturday with whatever's going to happen on Monday. So then you're just ready for Monday on Monday morning.
Having a son and having him get older and older, has that changed Monday for you? When he was little, were you like, oh, I don't want him to have to go to school today. But now it's like, okay, get out of the house.
Right, exactly. And, you know, and that's the difference too. Like, if you like where you're going on Monday, it helps. So, like, I love what I do for a living. So if I have to go do it on Monday, then I'm happy about that. Now, when you're a kid, though, and it's like school, yay, in the beginning, that's all fun. But by the time you're a teenager, it's like, oh, man, school. So, right. So getting him out of the house on Mondays is ridiculous. Like, I mean, it has just gotten harder and harder as he's gotten older, when it should have gotten easier. But it's just the attitude toward Monday, I think.
Do you think there's, like, a false narrative then that is tied to Monday that we should all kind of get over it? Or do you think it's just sort of it's going to stick with us forever?
Yeah, I think it's going to stick with us forever. I actually bought Sawyer a shirt that said Monday on it, just simply Monday, because he hated Monday so much, which he would only wear then, like, on Wednesdays and Thursdays, or, you know, just to confuse people. But the whole idea that you were starting this cycle all over again, I think, is what takes people down. But I just find, like, Monday mornings, like, really productive. I right away get to, like, okay, what's my week going to be? And what am I going to do this week? And I schedule interviews and I kind of plot out, like, what's going to happen. So you get, like, this full view of everything. Mm. Like, there's so much potential there. And then by Thursday, when you only got, like, half of all the things done that you thought you were going to do, and then you realize that now you're just freaking out because there's just no way to push it all into 2 days. But Monday, you got 5 days. Like, there's so much time. There is so much potential to get everything you want to do in the week done, and then you can't.
That's Karina Bland, columnist for the Arizona Republic and AZ Central. That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix.
You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Steve Goldstein. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.